Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Looking at the whole face, not just looking into people's eyes, looking at what their body does, do their changes in their movements. These are all trainable skills. It means taking in much more information than just the words, which many people tend to do.
Clark Freshman, the subject of today's interview on IDN, is a professor of law at Hastings Law School in San Francisco and is also the head of training for the Ekman Group, where he teaches negotiation training and also lawyer training in identifying and managing basic emotions, emotions which are common among all people across cultures. In this interview today, Clark discusses common mistakes and assumptions that people make when they're in a cross-cultural context, what the basic emotions are that everyone has across all cultures, and how they can improve their ability to spot and interpret emotions in order to optimize their negotiation positions. It's a little like, well, mind reading. That's one way of looking at it. Another is that with all the courses and training that are available from different organizations about working in cross-cultural environments and negotiating across cultures with a focus on the differences, what about taking a more universalist approach, an approach that's even Darwinian in how it goes about connecting us to each other and the way that we act towards each other? For those who don't know, tell us a little bit about Paul Ekman and the Ekman Group.
Well, Paul Ekman is the world's leading authority on lie detection. He started his work about 30 years ago looking into emotions and culture. And his real question was, is it true, as Margaret Mead maintained at the time, that culture is the big deal, that there's no emotion apart from a specific culture? And he went back to Darwin and argued that no, culture actually has evolved for evolutionary purposes, or rather emotion has evolved for evolutionary purposes, and it's universal. There may be parts of it that are distinct, but there are certain universal emotions.
And I did a very interesting, by the way, annotated version of a book that Darwin had written late in his career about the expressions of emotions in man and animals.
Yes, that's correct. And what he found is actually crucial to some of our research today. So he found that there were seven basic emotions. This is what Paul Ekman found. And one of those expressions of emotion, the emotion of fear or distress, shows up in the exact way that Darwin had suggested, that the inner eyebrows, just the inner eyebrows, will come up forming a kind of horseshoe on the forehead. This shows up both in people in the United States, in Japan, even in Papua New Guinea when Paul studied that over three decades ago. It also shows up in certain primates as well. So it really is true that one can learn the basic expressions of emotion which show up in all sorts of cultures.
All over the world. But it's worth noting, too, that he and his research are featured very prominently in the Malcolm Gladwell books, The Tipping Point and Blink, I think even more prominently in Blink.
And in Blink, it describes how Paul went through this research, and by inserting different needles in all of his facial muscles, he identified all the facial muscles that were involved in expressions and how there was a kind of two-way interaction. So one of the things that was discovered is that there are these universal expressions of emotion, these seven basic emotions.
One of them, sticking needles in your face, sort of.
Sticking needles in your face, you discover.
Don't do this at home. For those
listening, do not do this at home. Do not do this on research subjects. He actually did it on himself and with a colleague because they couldn't get approval to do it on research subjects. So he would find.
I can't imagine why.
He would find that stimulating certain muscles would actually stimulate certain emotions, and we've found out since then when people fake smiles, they actually will feel happier. When people put their faces into the expressions of anger, they start to get annoyed. And when people are annoyed, they start to get certain facial expressions. So it's a very useful
big connection
feedback
between the physical features and what happens with them and the actual emotions that it triggers in the brain.
Yeah. That's exactly correct. And that is used now in national security training. So at airports throughout the United States and in many airports worldwide, security officials are trained so that they can identify certain emotions. For example, when we looked at the 9/11 hijackers to see which emotions showed up in their face, it mostly was contempt and disgust. Contempt and disgust are emotions that would allow one to cause massive damage to someone else because one might view them like an insect. They're beneath us, they're worthy of contempt, they're disgusting, they should just be eradicated.
And so this is all relevant, I guess, to listeners who are involved in dispute negotiations and dispute resolution internationally, because there are a lot of things that are in common no matter where you go around the world, right?
That's correct. And what people may get confused about is to think that it's important to pay attention to particular cultures, that we think that certain cultures, such as Japanese cultures, may not have as much emotion as other types of cultures.
You hear that. Yeah.
And we hear these stereotypes. In fact, the research shows that Japanese, when they're shown films of amputations, they show the same facial expressions of emotion as American students who are shown that. What's different is the Japanese will clamp down on the emotions, conceal them more quickly. The Americans, especially when others are present, will exaggerate the emotions. So when we think that other cultures may not show as much emotion, we're really not paying attention enough to these very quick expressions of emotion that do show up.
So it matters in a negotiation that you set your expectations for what the other side may or may not be like. It's very easy to stereotype.
It's very easy to stereotype, and it's very easy to miss out on clues about the other side if we assume that everything is cultural. We may not know in advance what's the most relevant culture. You may negotiate, as we were talking about earlier, with someone in Saudi Arabia and think, oh, in Saudi Arabia, the culture has a more leisurely view of time. But that may not be the culture for a particular negotiation. If it's a state-owned enterprise, it may be a relatively leisurely notion of time.
Common to state-owned, but more bureaucratic.
More deliberative, more bureaucratic, more willing to go through extra motions, more hierarchical, checking with other people. On the other hand, an entrepreneurial culture where it's not state-owned, or an engineering culture where it's
people
very
facing
fast-paced.
Deadlines, got to deliver, numbers may be more similar to another entrepreneurial enterprise somewhere else.
That's correct. So the assumption that many people make that they need to identify the culture in advance may not be correct. What we
Or may lead you, and then this is something that I, by the way, I find a lot, is that people, it's very easy for people to say, oh, in this culture, I mean, whether we pick on Saudis or Americans or Italians, to say that this culture is a certain way and therefore you should expect these things in a particular negotiation. And it may lead you down the wrong path if you do that, because the person that you're negotiating with may actually be very similar to you or very different, but for reasons that have nothing to do with national culture.
And that can lead to unnecessary negative emotion, because if you are going slowly with somebody who expects it to go quickly, or the opposite, if you're going quickly with somebody who expects it to go slowly, they may become needlessly annoyed. So what can we do about that? Well, what we can do is to monitor for the emotions and for the thought processes during negotiation. So becoming aware, what are the changes that might indicate that the person is getting impatient or that the person is starting to get angry?
And these will be some of the same indications no matter where you are. If you're negotiating in South America or in Asia or in North America or Europe, there'll be commonalities among people that you will experience.
There are these universal expressions of facial emotion. There may be some slight variation. So let's take anger, for example. An early warning sign of anger for many people in many cultures is that the lower lip will involuntarily curl under, appearing to thin. This is a kind of suppressed or repressed kind of anger. When we see this in a negotiation, this is an early warning sign. This can tell us, slow down, even stop, rewind, ask the person a question, take a break, before it explodes into something more than that. Another example is contempt. Contempt is a very common emotion that can show up, and it's very dangerous. In research on marital couples, when a man shows contempt, it's a very reliable prediction, even in a 10-minute interaction, that the couple will be divorced or separated within a year. So contempt is very easy to recognize. It's a kind of half smile just on one side of the face.
So a lateral smile.
Yes, a unilateral smile. So it only shows up on one side.
Lateral being one side of the face. Corner,
yes.
Corner of the mouth pulling in up to one side.
That's correct. So it'll pull off to one side.
And
sometimes
this can be very
pull
quick.
Up.
These expressions, I think you call them micro expressions.
The micro expressions are concealed expressions. They can either be concealed or repressed. They show up 1/5, 1/30th of a second, maybe even faster than that. When we see that contempt arising, we don't know what it means. We don't know if the person is judging themselves. Maybe they feel guilty. Maybe they're thinking about something completely different. maybe they're judging
us. Their mind is wandering. And
their mind is wandering, but it is a dangerous sign. It's not the place that you want someone to be during a negotiation. So these are more reliable than our cultural stereotypes about what the person is going to act like. We may go in with some hypotheses. Maybe we think this is an engineering firm. They're going to be very quick. They're going to be very results-oriented, get to the point. When we start doing that, we notice the lower lip thinning. We may notice that the side of their mouth moves off to the side quickly and comes back. This is an early warning sign to reassess. The Dalai Lama uses a phrase, the spark before the flame. So before people get angry, before they call off the negotiation, or before they just walk away in a kind of cold anger, we can notice this early warning system and reassess what we're doing.
And you were saying when we spoke earlier, before we began recording, that you've found in the studies that people who are in real negotiation situations where there's a downside to not reaching an agreement. So if you say we're in a dispute negotiation and we don't settle, so there's a penalty to not settling. You're going to have a decision, whether it's by an arbitrator or by a judge somewhere, that leads to a lot more leakage. You said a lot more of these signals will come out that reveal hidden emotions than in a simulated situation where people are just sort of negotiating back and forth and there's no real penalty to not reaching a deal.
The experiments show that when we've done simulated interactions, if someone has some kind of a downside, so for example, money may be given to a political cause that we know in advance they don't like, they give off many more signals. So how does that apply to negotiations? If someone has a big stake in a negotiation, if they are the principal, we would expect that they would send off many more signals than if we're dealing with their attorney. If it's a high-stakes dispute, we would expect them to send off many more signals than if it's a low-stakes dispute. Dealing with a bureaucratic enterprise where there may be no personal stake for the individual that you're speaking with, we may not see as many of these signs as there might otherwise be.
So maybe to give an example from real life, and one that I've seen fairly often, is one where someone says, I don't have authority. And that may be a statement, if it comes from a private enterprise, that it may be that that's, you know, I guess you would look at that as a signal of, is this true or is it not true? Whereas someone who works for a state-owned entity may say, I have no authority, and it may really be the case because they work within a very complex bureaucracy and they never have authority. Very easy for them to say that.
And we may be mistaken about that. We may think that we know it's a bureaucracy, they're unlikely to have authority, but it may turn out that we're mistaken. So we want to be open-minded. So what are the clues in that particular example? Maybe the person says they have no authority, but we notice that there's a kind of leakage. Well, what does leakage mean? Leakage means that there's a change from the way that that person ordinarily acts. That's one possibility. Or that we're seeing these universal signs of emotion. So what might be some of those examples? So the first step would be finding out what someone's baseline is. And this involves looking at several different areas. So one area would be the voice. Does someone talk loud or soft? One of the things to pay particular attention to is when people lower their voice. This may indicate that they're less certain about their belief. So if someone says, we don't have authority, and it's the same level of volume as the rest of their statements, the way they usually speak, that's more believable than if the person lowers their voice and says, well, we don't have authority for that. That would be a soft spot indicating you might want to probe that later on.
So when you talk about a baseline and a soft spot, really what you're saying is that you need to look for changes in these nonverbal components, or verbal in this case. It's somebody who lowers their voice when they say a critical point, or if they don't have a habit of looking up and all of a sudden they do start looking up, that would be a change.
That's correct. So we're generally speaking, we are looking for changes. The one exception.
So you got to spend some time observing people, you know, before you get to these critical points to try to figure out how do they normally act.
Yes, how do they normally act? And that might mean observing them beforehand. It might mean small talk. It might mean not getting down to crucial issues first. And it might mean relaxing them in some way. One of the big problems that people may have in figuring out if someone is lying is that if people are nervous or anxious, it may not be that they're lying. It may just be that they're nervous for some reason. So we look to changes in the voice. We look to changes in the body. So examples of changes in the body are how much someone talks with their hands. An example could be their posture. When people are afraid, they tend to lean back. When they're more enthusiastic, they tend to lean forward. It's one example. Another thing that we'd look for is their verbal style. So some people speak relatively formally. When they start using jargon or informal, even swear language, that's a change in their verbal style. Some people speak very fluidly. Others pause as they're speaking. More or fewer pauses or changes in verbal style. Content, verbal content, is something else we look for. Does the person provide usually many details, but on some topics, relatively few details? Does the person explain, I don't have authority on certain issues, and they explain it needs to go through this office and this approval process, and this is who you would need to speak to? That may be one thing, the usual way they speak. On another issue, if they simply say, oh, I can't do that, this would be a change in their baseline.
So if you've observed the way they acted before, and let's say the person's not particularly communicative when they say things, and then they say, I don't have authority, and with that, I don't have authority because comes a lot of additional information of the type that they wouldn't normally give as a way of justifying that decision or that statement, that may be an indication that maybe they do have authority, but they don't want you to know.
That's correct. Sometimes it will be that they give too much detail, too many explanations. Other times it could be that they give too little detail.
They don't give
too little detail.
If it's usually somebody who gives a lot of detail, a lot of color, and they get to that point and they say, I'm sorry, I just don't have authority, without the usual detail around it, that could also be an indication.
That's correct.
Okay.
Same thing with the volume of the voice, raising it. Some people will raise it too much. Some people will raise it too little. Eye contact, the same thing. Some people think that if someone's looking in your eyes, a common American and English belief, they can't be lying to you. But in fact, people may exaggerate their eye contact when they are lying to you.
So the eye contact, again, may be a case where they're looking you in the eye because they're lying to you.
That's exactly correct. We had an ex-president who said, I did not sleep with that woman exactly as he stared directly and intently into the camera. So it's the change that's key. The one exception to all of this, the one exception to the change, is in the face. In the face, there are seven distinct emotions that run across all cultures that have been identified. And these specific patterns show up in every culture studied, whether it's England or Japan, the United States, even Papua New Guinea before it had contact with the outside world.
Universal emotions and how they're expressed on the face.
That's exactly correct.
And these emotions are, I think you said, there's one positive and six negative.
There's one positive emotion, happiness, which shows up. There are two variations.
Smiling.
There's the smiling, which can be a sincere or felt smile, which shows up both in the mouth, but also in a slight crinkling of the eyes. Or there's the social smile, which is just the movement of the mouth. Then we have several negative emotions. One that shows up a lot in negotiation is fear. And fear can show up in several different ways. The fear or distress that someone may have often shows up involuntarily in just the inner eyebrows going up, very briefly. It lasts as little as 1/30th of a second. People often don't notice this without training because they're looking at other parts of the face. They're staring into someone's eyes. They're thinking that that's where the information is, but really it's in the eyebrows that the fear is showing up. Other times the fear will show up in a tightening of the mouth, where the mouth will pull to the sides, becoming more horizontal. So for these kinds of emotions, the seven basic emotions, we know that there are relatively simple ways to learn that.
So let's start with the positive one, though, to give a quick example. Let's say I make an offer in a negotiation, and it's $1 million or euros, or whatever the currency is, and there's an almost imperceptible, very quick smile on the other side that gets shut down immediately or hidden away. And the statement comes back, oh, that's much too high or much too low. What you're saying, I guess, is that may be an indication that maybe my offer wasn't too high or too low, but it's already something that they would be happy with.
That's exactly correct. So sometimes what will show up when you make an offer that's acceptable to them is that they will show the happiness and then clamp down on it. The other thing to look for is what's not there. If the person says, oh, that's something that is very insulting to us, but there are no actual facial signs of anger on their face, that's significant as well. So we're looking for both of those things, both the happiness and the absence of any negative emotion.
So let's talk about what do you do about these emotions if you can. I guess you're going to say you can improve on your ability to detect these emotions. How do you improve?
Yes, it has been shown that this is a skill that can be learned by nearly everyone, even people with autism on the autism spectrum. even people with schizophrenia, they can improve their recognition of emotion in about an hour to 2 hours. And we have a tool that we've developed, the micro-expression training tool, which shows people examples of these very quick emotions, 1/5 to 1/30th of a second, explains how these different emotions show up on the face, and has a pre-test, a training, review, and post-test. That all takes between an hour and 2 hours and will lead to improvement for nearly everyone.
So then let's go to the next stage, though. Let's say you've now improved, you're better, or you just always naturally were good at spotting these emotions, and you see one of these emotions. You see somebody changing from their baseline. They were very expressive before. They now say something. They say, you know, moving their hands around before, but this time they say with their hands, you know, firmly together, I believe that we have a very strong position. And there's some other nonverbal component that may suggest stress or fear, or maybe they're not so confident in their position. What do we do in that situation?
Well, the first thing is to think before one's acting. Because if one notices something such as leakage, it's something the other person either is not aware of themselves, it's unconscious to them, or that they are not wanting to share with you. The temptation many students have is to call the person out, to say, I don't believe you, or you don't seem very confident, or I think you do have authority. This may not be... Many negotiators may have that tendency, particularly people from a legal background, may have the sense of wanting to prove that they have some superior knowledge. This may just lead to an escalation of negative emotion. And what we know from research is when there's an escalation of negative emotion, people are less likely to reach agreements, they're less flexible, more likely to engage in threats. So that's something to be avoided.
Interesting. So if say I'm negotiating a disagreement and they say, I think that we have a very strong position, and there's fear that we can detect, some sense of that, well, not only are they don't believe that, but they may be afraid. We don't want to call them out necessarily on that. That may actually just lead to a worsening of the negotiation situation.
That's correct. So sharing the information with the other person directly can lead to a worsening of the situation. What one can do is test out your belief. So if you think that you've made an offer which they are able to accept, a tendency, and they've said it's not acceptable, you might otherwise come back and bid against yourself, offer a higher price if you're buying something. Instead, you might be silent. Just wait for the other person to acquiesce. Wait for the other person to accept the offer. They may be testing you at a conscious or unconscious level, and your non-reacting to them will communicate that you have confidence in your position. So it's not necessary to challenge them directly.
So don't press them. Don't challenge their statement, I believe that we have a strong position, but maybe just wait them out. Stick to your position. Don't move. Let them make the next move and see where it goes from there.
Yes, that's one tactic. A second tactic is to move on to another issue or another topic and to return to the same question again.
Later. So cultivate some more positive emotions, some more positive feelings before you get back to one where you're obviously stuck. Before we go, it would be interesting if you could give us an example of, you know, in some of the classes that you teach or examples that you've learned where learning and becoming attuned to these emotions and the changes in the course of an interaction between people have had an impact.
Yes, in one instance, someone was applying for a visa to enter the United States. A typical question there is, does the person intend to enter the United States and stay there, or, which would not be acceptable, or does the person intend to enter the United States in order to commit certain kinds of hostile acts, even acts of terrorism? One person was asked when he had previously been to the United States, and he listed several different cities that he had gone to. Houston was one, Washington was another, and then he said, and New York. When he said, and New York, there was a pause in his voice, and his voice noticeably went down at that point. This is a clue to us that there might be some reason why he did not want to mention New York, and that would be an area to investigate further and to ask questions about. The second thing that he did was that when he said he visited Houston, he was asked, who did you see in Houston? In the rest of his interview, he was quite detailed. What did he study in Paris? He spoke of the classes. When he was asked about who he saw in Houston, he again lowered his voice and he said, friends and family. This was suspicious because the change in level of detail raised questions about who else he might have been seeing in Houston. As a result of this, the Foreign Service officer interviewing him made a decision to refer this for further investigation rather than to just grant the visa.
So this is examples where these things are being applied in real life. I guess we don't know the outcome, whether or not the person was found to have been lying or not. But there, I guess it's also important if you're applying for a visa or coming into the United States or someplace else, people are now receiving these trainings. So be careful about the changes.
That's right. To be monitoring one's own changes, and as a negotiator, when meeting with others, to be monitoring yourself, are you changing your voice at certain points? And that may be for other reasons. It may be because you're starting to feel tired and you're jet-lagged, a reason to make sure that you're rested during negotiation. Are you inadvertently not providing enough detail on certain kinds of issues? Are you starting to get nervous because you had too much coffee and your hands are moving more than they usually do? It means monitoring yourself as well.
All right. Well, great. Thanks so much.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.